ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, inflation up, interest rates on hold. We find out what the RBA governor says hard-pressed households can expect in the year ahead. Also, ahead of the field, Jamie Mellum becomes only the second woman in history to ride a Melbourne Cup winner. And the Egg and Sperm Donor Clinic with a loyalty program. A win for would-be parents or a red flag for bioethicists.
Using a program like this risks undermining the moral significance of procreation. The loyalty program where you earn points does raise some serious questions about how commercial incentives are influencing reproductive medicine.
The Reserve Bank has left interest rates on hold in a move that was widely expected but will disappoint many Australians. The cash rate remains at 3.6% until at least next month's meeting, though a cut then is also looking unlikely. The move follows last week's surprise jump in inflation for the September quarter. Isabel Musali prepared this report.
In Perth's CBD, shoppers run for cover during an unusual spring downpour. And their views on the economy aren't much brighter.
Federally, it's terrible. There's a lot of pain that we're all feeling as we're retirees, and we're feeling it ourselves, even though we're self-funded, but we are still feeling it. The economy overall is just not producing anything for anybody. Our standard of living has gone backwards, literally.
I think it's shifting a lot, and it's hard for people to know where it's going and how it's going to move forward.
Really, really bad. I feel sorry for families with children. It's just not good enough. The Australian government isn't doing good enough. It'll probably get worse before it gets better. Yeah, which is a shame. It really is a shame. It's really hard to tell, though.
But this retiree is much more optimistic.
Everybody, all my kids and their friends, all seem to have good jobs and having a, you know, house prices are a bit alarming, but the rest of it, it seems to be doing well.
The Reserve Bank decided to leave interest rates on hold at 3.6%, citing an increase in core inflation. Governor Michelle Bullock says the board didn't even consider a cut.
Unemployment went up a little bit more than we expected, but so did inflation. So we're being a little bit cautious here as to what we read. We think there's a little bit of information in both. Naturally, the board are concerned about employment as well, because that's part of their mandate. But we're, I'd say at the moment, a little more concerned about making sure that we do get inflation sustainably back in the band. Because as the forecasts show in the Statement on Monetary Policy, this blip in September is going to stay in the inflation numbers for basically the next 12 months. So it's going to have a 3 on it, which is not ideal.
And with many households already tightening their belts for some time, the governor was asked who's to blame for the uptick in inflation.
It's possibly telling us that there's a little more excess demand in the economy than we had thought. And it's sometimes hard for people to understand that, but if you take just a microcosm, a very sort of simple example, I don't know how many people have tried to get a tradie perhaps to work on their house. It's difficult. What that's telling you is that in that particular microcosm of the Australian economy, that the demand for these services is above the ability of this to supply it. So that's what I mean when I say demand is a bit above supply, and when that happens, inflation tends to rise.
There's just one RBA meeting left this year, but economists put the chance of a rate cut at almost zero. Looking ahead, Michelle Bullock says it's possible there are no more cuts, and it's possible there are more. And that brings little comfort to those on the streets of Perth.
Well, I mean, obviously, being paying a mortgage. I would love for the interest rate to go down, but I think it's okay as long as we get a bit more of certainty of what's going on.
Mortgage broker Yulia doesn't expect any clarity or rate cuts anytime soon.
I think that's it for this year. Next year it's hard to say. Maybe by March we'll have another cut. I would suggest we all focus on the family, own family, you know, change the lifestyle, be more conservative.
Mortgage broker Yulia ending that report from Isabel Massali. Warren Hogan is the economic advisor to Judo Bank. He joined me a short time ago. Warren Hogan, the RBA Governor Michelle Bullock says the central bank may have misjudged the gap between supply and demand in the Australian economy. How has that happened?
Well, it's a very uncertain economic environment we're in, not just because of all the things we know, like the geopolitics and climate change and all these things that we worry about. But the reality is we have a big demographic shift occurring. We've got a lot of new technology coming through. And economists are finding it very difficult to have confidence in their traditional economic model. So really, we are finding it harder than ever to get a handle on where the economy is going. And I think this is really a highlight of that, that the RBA has misjudged the underlying strength of the economy or demand in the economy. And of course, that is the basic implication of that much higher than expected inflation figure we got last week.
She used that word uncertainty many times in her press conference this afternoon, but she did say she thinks interest rates are in the right spot at the moment to respond to any problem spots in the economy. How long do you think until borrowers see another cut, in your view?
Well, I think the message from the governor, if not the message from the inflation numbers last week, is that we should not be really thinking about rate cuts anymore, not just in the next few months, but rates are at best on hold for this foreseeable future. And depending what happens next, they could move in either direction. Now, the governor didn't go as far as saying that because I think she is still trying to maintain a view that inflation is going to go back to their target in the future. But we don't need to see very much happen from here in terms of a stronger economy or another set of high inflation numbers before they're going to have to start thinking about whether they have to raise interest rates. Now, that may not happen. We just don't know. But the idea that the next move in rates is down is not assured, and that's the big shift in the last week.
I think when she was asked about it, she said anything is possible. So how many months before a possible upward move in rates?
Look, I think they will only raise rates if they absolutely have to, and that means they will need quite a run of data and some evidence building over a number of months before they get to that point. So I don't think we need to worry about it anytime soon, but I think that the window for a rate hike would probably open in May. It gives them another 6 months of data, but we'll start to learn a lot more about it over the course of our summer. If our consumer stays reasonably robust through the key Black Friday all the way through to Christmas sales, like what's coming up in the next 8 weeks, if our businesses are starting to hire again, and then most importantly, if the next few inflation numbers, which we are now going to get every month, not just every quarter, if they remain uncomfortably high or worse, start to get even higher, then we'll be talking about whether or not they're going to hike rates pretty soon in 2026.
Now, on inflation, Michelle Bullock says that it being just below 3% is not good enough for the board as she sees it, and she's reasserted that the board is aiming for 2.5%. What are your takeaways from her comments about inflation?
Well, it's exactly right. I mean, they have a target of 2.5%. That is the midpoint of their 2-3% target band. We've had now almost 5 years of inflation above target. And also, it should not be forgotten that we are targeting higher inflation than just about any other major economy, where the accepted approach is actually 2% inflation. So I think her firmness on that view is absolutely appropriate. It's reinforcing to Australians, whether it be business people or consumers, that they are going to do this. But the problem that the governor has and the RBA Monetary Policy Board has is that if we keep getting inflation numbers that are above that target for too much longer, their credibility is going to come under pressure. And of course, that is a key problem, because when people start thinking the central bank isn't going to hit its targets, that's when they start asking for more wages, when they start putting their prices up. That's an inflationary environment. And in my view, that has to be avoided at all costs, given how exposed we are to higher interest rates through our heavily indebted household sector.
Warren Hogan, thanks very much for joining PM.
Thanks, Rachel.
And Warren Hogan is the economic advisor to Judo Bank. The Liberal Party has now mapped out a path to settling on a position on net zero. Liberals are still digesting the National Party's weekend decision to formally dump the commitment to reach net zero emissions by 2050. For more, I spoke earlier to political reporter Isabella Tolhurst. Bella, what has the coalition been saying about net zero today?
Well, many members of the coalition have been keeping their cards close to their chest about where they think the Liberal Party may land. There have been some rumblings around whether net zero could be enough to divide the coalition, but several politicians have been quick to shoot that down. National Senator Matt Canavan said he would like to see the Libs join the Nats on this policy platform, but that it's ultimately a choice for the Liberals. Liberal member Melissa McIntosh said that she felt that the media was making a bigger deal of this than how it feels for them internally in the party, and that the Liberals will get it right in the end, but that it just might look a bit messy on the journey there. Senator Andrew Bragg, Liberal Senator, has probably had the strongest comments today. He says that the Liberals shouldn't stick with the Nats at any cost. He is a staunch defender of net zero and says that we signed up for the Paris Agreement and it's our obligation to see that through. And then what of people like Barnaby Joyce? He took another week off from the coalition party room, but he said he was very pleased that his push to repeal net zero had been successful within his own party, but he still kept his cards close to his chest over whether he plans to break up with the Nationals or stay with them after all.
And what's Labor's response been?
Well, Labor have been a bit more vocal today and taking the opportunity to have a couple of jabs at the coalition over their disarray, I suppose. They had their own caucus meeting this morning where the Prime Minister said the coalition was, quote, tearing itself apart. He used the opportunity to contrast Labor's, quote, discipline and orderly and considered approach to government with the coalition's unrest. This also came to a head in Question Time, where we saw Labor using this sort of as a weapon against the coalition. Anytime the coalition raised a question to the government about things like cost of living or policy or inflation, the government were very quick to turn that back around on the opposition and poke at them for not having a strong energy policy. And they really sort of utilised that to their advantage today.
And separately, the RBA has announced it'll keep interest rates on hold. What's the political reaction been so far?
Well, the reaction we've had so far has largely been in Question Time. Shadow Treasurer Ted O'Brien had a go at the government for failing to bring down inflation. Susan Lee said that Labor had failed to deliver a Christmas rate cut and painted this picture of Australians struggling through the festive period as a result of Labor failing to bring prices down. Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, however, pointed to the fact that there have been three rate cuts this year, and he reiterated that inflation was much higher when Labor came into office and it has come down under their government. But he did concede that, of course, Australians would have preferred to have more relief and that this will be a disappointing result for Australians today.
Political reporter Isabella Tolhurst. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You'd be hard-pressed these days to find a service that doesn't offer a rewards program from flights, groceries, makeup and even pharmaceuticals. But what about a frequent flyer program for fertility clinics? An international egg and sperm bank has approached Australian IVF clinics with a program that would see clinics earn credits for donations to the bank, raising a red flag for bioethicists. Janelle Miles reports.
It's called the World Egg and Sperm Bank, and it's located on the other side of the globe in the American state of Arizona. But it's under the spotlight in Australia this week after proposing what's being described as a frequent flyer program for egg donations.
I think this might be, the permissibility of this might be slightly more complex than simply whether it's right or wrong.
Dr. Molly Johnson is an ARC industry fellow at Monash University's Bioethics Centre.
And I think here we need to be careful to not automatically conflate a commercial involvement with moral wrongdoing, because we need to remember that in Australia, most of assisted reproduction is available in a commercial setting. We have very limited public provision of ART.
In an email seen by the ABC, the American company offered Australian IVF clinics a client success reward program that would see the clients awarded credits for egg donations. Those credits could offset, and in some cases fully cover, the cost of donor eggs for patients. But there's concern it creates the risk of biased decision-making, with clinics potentially influenced by incentives rather than clinical or ethical considerations. And there are also questions about transparency.
You know, it's unknown whether clinics would disclose their relationship with the banks to patients. And this is something that's a really important element, because if this is not disclosed to patients, then this risks undermining informed consent.
Dr. Johnston warns the use of royalty programs as marketing mechanisms risks transforming eggs or gametes into a transactional product.
It's not the fact that it is commercial involvement that is problematic in itself. It's the fact that this is reproduction, and reproduction is not like other markets and other products.
Dr. David Malloy is the national chair of the IVF Medical Directors Group in Australia, which has written to all IVF clinics operating in this country.
In Australia, donor material is very much done on a voluntary basis. And there are very strict rules about commercial incentivization and payment for donor material. If you're going to get involved in this program, you know, get the most careful legal, ethical advice, because this is the sort of program that might cause concern, and therefore there is a risk of reputational injury.
It is legal to actually pay companies such as this for eggs, but once they get to Australia, you can't trade in them.
That's exactly right. We purchase eggs from companies on behalf of patients. The costs are meant to reflect the genuine cost of providing those eggs to donor shipping and all the administration that goes into having a meaningful and safe donor program.
In a statement, the World Egg and Sperm Bank says while the concept had been proposed, the program hasn't been implemented. The Fertility Society of Australia and New Zealand says it's highlighted the need for nationally harmonised laws covering assisted reproduction, and it's also advising its members to exercise caution.
Janelle Miles reporting. It's one of the highest honours in science in the country. Aerosol physicist Lydia Moravska has taken out the top prize in the Prime Minister's Science Awards. The renowned air quality expert was instrumental in highlighting to the world the risk of airborne transmission during the COVID-19 pandemic. Alison Shaw reports.
Many of us barely think about the air we breathe, but Lydia Moravska has dedicated her life to understanding it.
There's basically no organ in our body which is not affected by air pollution.
The Queensland scientist, originally from Poland, studies ultrafine particles, which are tiny pollutants small enough to enter the bloodstream. Lydia Moravska has won this year's Prime Minister's Prize for Science with an award ceremony in Canberra last night.
So Lydia has been recognised for redefining air pollution science and reshaping policy advice to vastly improve how the world mitigates pollution risk. Congratulations, Lydia.
It's a feeling that you kind of speechless. It's hard to believe this.
The air quality expert heads up the International Laboratory for Air Quality and Health at the Queensland University of Technology. But it was her work during the COVID-19 pandemic that earned her global recognition. Initially, the World Health Organization announced in March 2020 that the virus was not airborne, a declaration that turned out to be incorrect.
My initial reaction was that they were completely wrong. Based on the research we did over the past 10 or then 15 years, I knew that the virus is airborne.
But Professor Moravska says it was a challenging task to convince the World Health Organization and the world that COVID-19 could be spread through airborne transmission.
And the beginning of the pandemic, you remember you went to the supermarket and saw people with gloves, nobody wearing masks. So it was so embedded in the public health control measures, like changing any dogmas is extremely difficult.
Alongside Professor Murawska, seven other scientists were recognised for their work in teaching, innovation and research. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese praising the winners today during question time.
I congratulate all the winners, and it's important that as a nation we don't just celebrate our sporting achievements, but also that we acknowledge that Australia punches way above our weight with other areas of innovation in science as well. And last night was a chance to celebrate that.
This year, a new award was given out, the Prize for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Knowledge Systems, won by Murdoch University Professor Michael Weir. The Malgana man established an Indigenous-led commercial fishery in Western Australia that sustainably harvests sea cucumbers and helps to restore seagrass.
I think my people are great observers, and the one thing we were taught and was passed down from all our elders was to make sure you look at the environment. When the 2011-2012 heatwave happened, we saw the trade-off, you know, the seagrass died but the sea cucumbers got bigger, and it was like, why? That kind of led the curious mind to say, okay, we can do something to fix the environment.
As for Lydia Murawska, she says there's plenty more research she wants to work on after receiving the $250,000 prize. Her passion now is focusing on new regulations for indoor air quality.
Now I'm thinking more how it will help me in bringing the topic of air quality into the mainstream such that something can be done to improve it.
Air quality expert Professor Lydia Murawska ending that report from Alison Shaw. Jockey Jamie Mellum has become only the second woman in history to win a Melbourne Cup, riding Australian-bred horse Half Yours to victory on a wet track at Melbourne's Flemington Racecourse. In doing so, she's also become the first female jockey in history to win the Melbourne Cup and the Caulfield Cup in the same year. She joins the history books alongside Michelle Payne, who 10 years ago was the first female to claim the Melbourne Cup. Kimberly Price filed this report.
Half Yours is coming clear for Jamie Carr for the Cuff double. Half Yours, the history maker, won the Lexus Melbourne Cup by 3 lengths.
It was a race that will go down in history. 29-year-old Jamie Mellum becomes the first female jockey to claim the Melbourne Cup and the Caulfield Cup in the same racing week. Riding on 5-year-old Half Yours, it was a feat that left her speechless.
What just happened? Oh my God. This is what we do it for. This is why we get up out of bed every morning, 4 a.m. Just won the Melbourne Cup.
And it was a sentimental race for Jamie Mellum.
I have to mention my grandpa, he died last week. The last thing he watched was the Caulfield Cup, and he was such a big supporter of mine.
Half Yours was the only Australian-bred galloper in this year's field of 24. After the race, Jamie Mellum was embraced by her friend and former jockey, Michelle Payne.
Welcome to the club. This is what it feels like.
It does. And what a ride.
A decade ago, Michelle Payne became the first female in Melbourne Cup history to win the $10 million race. Riding on Prince of Penzance in 2015, she recognised her groundbreaking win in these terms.
Just want to say to everyone else can get stuff because they think women aren't strong enough, but we just beat the world.
Dr. Andrew Lemon watched the race at Flemington Racecourse and is a consultant historian to the Victoria Racing Club.
Well, everybody had been feeling a little bit damp because it did start to shower, but gosh, they lifted when she won the race. It was quite a transformation. It just shows you the power of sport. It's just a really significant turning of the pages of history to say that women are now able to beat the boys in their own game without having to apologise for it.
As always, it was a colourful day with people travelling from near and far to watch the race that stops the nation.
It's a pretty special event, yeah, and that's very exciting to be here.
The millinery came first and then we designed the dress and the whole outfit based around the millinery. We come down from Mackay in North Queensland.
At the moment, I haven't got my right shoes on because of the wet weather.
As long as there's no rain, it'll be a great day, and as long as we back a winner.
The Melbourne Cup is still an enormous boon, according to economic author and University of Technology Sydney Professor Tim Harcourt.
Well, it's $1 billion for Australia, $52 million spent on retail fashion,
46,000 hats, 43,000 shoes, 46,000 dresses, and then accommodation and $36 million in hospitality.
Every year, the Melbourne Cup sparks protests amongst anti-gambling and animal rights activists.
There is no excuse for animal abuse.
Horse racing kills.
Gambling rates on horse racing have dropped in recent years, but Racing Victoria figures show the five-year average spend on the Melbourne Cup remains steady at $220 million. Tim Harcourt believes much of that isn't serious bettors.
Horse racing, particularly the Melbourne Cup, is for the people that want to have a bet once a year.
Later this week, the Oaks and Stakes Days will round out Melbourne's spring racing carnival.
Kimberly Price there. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For months, there's been great hope of a November interest rate cut to coincide with the Melbourne Cup. But now, with inflation rising again, all bets are off. What have the three rate cuts already granted this year done to house prices? Today, finance expert Alan Kohler on why the only way is up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.